Hello, everyone. Thanks for joining us on this call. My name is Mina, and as SimSec's Director of External Relations, I have the honor of moderating today's call on maritime security trends in the Asia-Pacific. For our SimSec listeners, I'm pleased to say we have an exciting panel lined up with four distinguished Asia-Pacific experts joining us to discuss security issues in the maritime domain from various different angles. Before we begin, I would like to begin introduce our panelists. We have joining us today Captain Jim Funnell, a government fellow with the Geneva Center for Security Policy. Jim retired from the U.S. Navy in January 2015 after spending 30 years as a naval intelligence officer specializing in Asia-Pacific security with an emphasis on the Chinese Navy and its operations. We have Greg Poling, director of the Asia Maritime Transparency Initiative and a fellow with the Southeast Asia Program at the Center for Strategic and International Studies. He oversees research on U.S. foreign policy in the Asia-Pacific with a particular focus on the maritime domain and the countries of Southeast Asia. We have Elena Nord, Director for Foreign Policy and Security Studies at the Institute of Strategic and International Studies Malaysia. Her policy interests include U.S.-Malaysia bilateral relations, cyber warfare and security, radicalization and terrorism, and major power relations. And Scott Cheney-Peters also joins us, founder and chairman of SimSec and a reservist in the U.S. Navy. His interests focus on maritime security in the Asia-Pacific and naval applications of emerging technologies. The views expressed are those of Scott alone and not necessarily a representative of the U.S. government or U.S. Navy. Without further ado, I'd like to begin with Jim. Jim, can you talk us through the most significant changes to the Chinese Navy over the course of 2016 from either a doctrinal or capabilities perspective? Also, considering the prospects for U.S.-China cooperation or conflict in the upcoming year, and finally, the incident or the spat over the U.S. UV that China picked up last month, are those incidents likely to increase or decrease over the upcoming year?
Well, thanks, Mina, first of all, for thanks for coordinating this and inviting me to participate. I'm very happy to be working again with SimSec and the great work that you all do. To answer your questions as concisely as possible, I think the biggest things that happened, in my view, in 2016, and I just spent the last couple of days looking at about 10,000 of my emails from the Red Star Rising over the last year, and what seemed to come out to me or draw it out to me was the first and most obvious thing was about a year ago this time, you know, the major changes that President Xi instituted for the PLA, creating a separate People's Liberation Army headquarters, elevating the status of the Strategic Rocket Forces and the Strategic Support Force, and then the reorganization from seven military regions to five theater commands, all had a kind of an indirect, I think, impact on the Navy in terms of elevating their status, I think, that was already on the rise previous to 2016, but I think that continued to be demonstrated throughout the year, this last year, in the numbers of events that the Chinese Navy held, not only exercises, you know, inside the First Island Chain, but the great number of operations that occurred outside the First Island Chain, and then their kind of their global operations that had, you know, their task forces operating not only in the Indian Ocean, but in the Mediterranean, up into the Baltic, and then down into the South South Pacific, and over into South America. So I think what we saw is just a solidification, and maybe a culmination of Admiral Wu Shengli's final year in office, if you will, as the director of or the chief of naval operations for the Chinese Navy. And I think you saw also that, you know, a recognition by President Xi that the PLA Navy is kind of the principal tool for power acquisition for China and kind of the maintenance of their, you know, their outward focus for the One Belt, One Road initiative. I think you also saw, you know, China participating in RIMPAC 2016 last year, which is a very big, I think, operation for them and a kind of a solidification of what they did in 2014 and 2012, establishing the pattern there that they expect, I think, to continue in 2018, and we'll see how that goes. In terms of shipbuilding, from my read, it looks like they built about 4.1 are 4.5 times as many ships as the U.S. In the year 2016. So their shipbuilding program continued pretty strong. And as I said, they were globally deployed in many ways, even with submarines, again, out into the Indian Ocean. While they were operating and doing fleet reviews in India, so it's a kind of a hard power, soft power approach, I think, by the Chinese. In terms of 2017, what we can look for, I think, are going to look for more of the same in terms of their presence. They've made it clear that, you know, they had previously made it clear before 2016 that they wanted to kind of break outside the first island chain. They demonstrated that very consistently in 2016, culminating the year with a lot of their naval air forces flying outside the first island chain with bombers and fighters and refuelers, circumnavigating Taiwan with their aircraft and their carrier. And I think we can expect to see much more of that in 2017. I think we can expect to see the rollout of the new carrier, their indigenous carrier, so it'd be the second carrier for them, but their first one that they produced themselves. I think we'll also start to get more information, or at least they'll talk about that their ballistic missile submarines are officially on you know, SLBM patrol and helping to shore up that portion of their nuclear deterrent capability that they've been talking about. So I think we're going to expect to see more of that. In terms of controversies and things, you know, what happened with the UUV here at the end of this last year, it's quite possible that we'll see things of that nature. I think what you'll see, though, is that, especially in the South China Sea as it relates to the disputed territories down in the Spratly Islands and even at Scarborough, you're going to see the Chinese incrementally continue to react to the United States presence. By my read, since October of 15 up through all of 2016 and even into 2017, the Chinese have taken a man-to-man approach in terms of dealing with the presence of the U.S. Navy in the South China Sea. Before October of 15, you could describe it as a zone defense. And I think now it's every time we've done one of these four freedom of navigation operations, or when we've had dual carrier operations or single carrier operations, the Chinese have gone out of their way to make clear and publicize that they are shadowing and following our naval vessels now as soon as they come into the South China Sea. And I think we can expect to see that increase and the pressure from their vessels to become a little bit sharper in tone. And you know, I don't expect to see shouldering or ramming or anything like that, but it is all dependent upon how they interpret the new administration. And they will use statements and any other, you know, things that come out of the new administration as justification for their actions. And so we have to be prepared for that. So I think that probably gets me around 4 or 5 minutes there, as you asked. So let me know if you need anything else. But that's kind of the way I see it in 2017.
Yeah, that's great. Thank you so much, Jan. Now I'd like to turn to Greg about the turning more towards the South China Sea. What do you think are the most salient facts to know about China's recent construction activities in the South China Sea? And also, to make sense of their construction activities, what are the key indicators you'll be looking for in 2017? And finally, with last year's major events, with PCA ruling and also perhaps this year potential ASEAN Code of Conduct, could any of these things modify Chinese behavior?
Thanks, Mia. I think what we saw certainly over the last year is continued consolidation by China of the installations made in the Spratlys and expansion of its capabilities in the Paracels, all while, at least in the second half of the year, pretty successfully diverting international criticism of its efforts diplomatically. So, you know, if you only read the press on the South China Sea in 2016, it looked like two different years. The first half of the year was high-level bullying, especially of the Philippines, but also of everybody else, in an effort to prevent nations from publicly supporting the PCA ruling, along with you know, this will-they-won't-they debate about construction at Scarborough, which the U.S. seems to have successfully deterred in the short term. But after the July ruling, all of a sudden we heard at least tonal change from the Chinese. The election of President Rodrigo Duterte in the Philippines opened that door, but Beijing gladly walked through it, and they continued to lash out at the U.S., at Australia, at Japan, at Singapore for perceived support of the Philippines, but toward the rest of ASEAN, and certainly toward the rest of the Filipinos, they took a more polite approach. And that pretty successfully helped them avoid the widespread censure that I think would have at least brought some pressure to change Chinese actions. Since that didn't happen, I think they'll see that they have largely a green light to return to a more coercive stance in 2017. So while all of this change in tone and all the diplomatic effort was going on, we still saw the completion of 72 small hangars for combat aircraft at the three biggest islands in the Spratlys, construction of larger hangars for maritime patrol, heavy lift and refueling craft, continued upgrades to the port and docking facilities that are going to allow the Chinese Navy, Coast Guard, and their paramilitary forces to stay out in the southern regions of the South China Sea 24/7 in a way that they haven't been able to prior to the artificial island construction. And we continue to see the increase in their monitoring capabilities, radar facilities, signals intelligence. Fiery Cross Reef looks like it's being turned into a hub for all of this data collection apparatus. What I'm going to be looking for next seems almost inevitable is the first deployment of combat aircraft to the Spratlys. And I think that's really a matter of when, not if. The Chinese did not build all of this air infrastructure to not use it. I also think we should expect to see the deployment of first air missiles pretty soon. The HQ-9s that made waves early last year are still in place on Woody Island. Woody Island has in many ways been a lower scale model of what we see at Mischief, Scooby, and Fiery Cross Reef. So I suspect that we'll see those deployments soon. And they might very well be used early in the next U.S. administration as a test of the Trump team's willingness to confront the Chinese. If you're a Southeast Asian claimant, life's going to get a lot harder this year. So far, we've seen a backing off of the most aggressive activities by the Chinese, but it's also the middle of storm season. We don't have hundreds of fishermen out there getting into it with the Chinese like we will in the spring. I think we're going to see the next escalation triggered sooner rather than later, as just math works against us. The sheer numbers of Chinese vessels willing to try to close off the disputed area to the claimants is going to increase, whether we like it or not. Oh, and I'm sorry, the code of conduct, yes. Much has been made of this pledge by First Lieutenant Minister Wang Yi on the sidelines of the ARF that China would agree to a framework code of conduct by middle of 2017. But that is a pretty squishy commitment. I mean, one, I have no idea what a framework for a code of conduct means. I don't think anybody does. Two, we've seen no willingness of China to agree to a binding document, even if they did, nor to clarify their claims. So it's hard to imagine how you would figure out where one even applies. And three, if past behavior on China's part is the best indicator of future behavior, then this seems to be nothing more than a delaying tactic. It took a decade to get China to agree to the guidelines for implementation of the DOC, which have still not actually been implemented, and have really done nothing to prevent escalation of the disputes. So if we get a basically toothless precursor to a COC this year, I don't think that actually changes anything.
Yeah, great. Thank you so much, Rose, for it. Finally, Elena, focusing more on the bilateral aspect of the U.S.'s relationship with Southeast Asian states and how the U.S. is trying to promote the rule of law in this complicated dispute, how significant are the changes we saw in 2016 in terms of the U.S.'s relationship with Vietnam and with the Philippines? And how are other states such as Malaysia, Singapore, Indonesia in the region trying to respond to the increasing U.S.-China tensions?
Yeah, I think the short answer to your last question is with difficulty. But I think context is very important to keep in mind here. When considering Southeast Asian states and sometimes puzzling behavior of their respective leaders, I think we often tend to superimpose, you know, geopolitical major power rivalry, in this case the U.S. and China, and trying to understand some of that complex behavior. And we often fail to see things from the national perspective. So the Philippines, for example, a lot of very interesting developments took place in the last few months of 2016, Philippines being one of them. And I think there was a lot of perception that the U.S. was casting, sorry, the Philippines was casting aside the U.S. as its long-term ally and moving closer towards China in particular. But I think if you look at developments closer, you'll see that President Duterte was only trying to do and is only still trying to do what many other Southeast Asian countries have been doing for a very long time, which is trying to balance major powers in the region. We're all very small countries here, with the exception of perhaps Indonesia. And I think under President Aquino, the Philippines was perhaps seen as completely in U.S. favor, whereas President Duterte is, in my view, only really trying to rebalance that relationship, so to speak, and trying to bring it a little closer to the center and position the Philippines in the middle of all these very different and influential powers in the region, while trying to extract the maximum benefit for the Philippines itself. In terms of Vietnam, I think definitely the lifting of the arms embargo, conditional as it was, is still very significant. We know the bitter history between the U.S. and Vietnam. But again, you know, to cast this in light of this big U.S.-China rivalry, I think, is only one aspect of the consideration. Similarly, there's been a lot of talk about Malaysia also turning more towards China because of all these deals, which are primarily economic and investment-based. But also there was that defense deal that was done when Prime Minister Najib went on his official visit to Beijing in late October, early November 2016. The fact that Najib himself called it a landmark deal, I think, lent even more flavor to this idea that it was about Malaysia aligning itself more closely to China. But again, you know, to reiterate, if you look closer at the details, you'll see that the Malaysia-Chinese defense relationship is really very nascent and underwhelming, especially considering the fact that Malaysia and China had a defense MOU in 2005, and that hasn't really developed over the years. It's only in recent times, over the last 2 to 3 years, culminated in a tabletop exercise and a command post exercise. And I think from now on an annual basis, we'll see this joint exercise of friendship and cooperation. But really, it's just a confidence-building exercise that both the Chinese and Malaysian militaries are embarking on, and it's really just trying to assess the comfort level between the two militaries, when in fact the Malaysian military in particular has shared a very, very long and established and solid defense relationship with the U.S. In particular, but also with other countries in the region, such as Australia, even Singapore, and New Zealand. So I think if we view things in a more holistic sense and drill down to the details, you'll see that the U.S. relationship with Southeast Asian states is still very significant, but I caution anyone against trying to understand national developments in either the Philippines, Malaysia, Vietnam, Singapore, Indonesia as mainly a U.S.-China and pick your Southeast Asian country trilateral relationship. You know, it's more about national interest of each of the Southeast Asian states and how they position themselves between these major powers of the U.S. and China while trying to optimize their national interest in the midst of all this rivalry.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. Thank you so much for that insight. Finally, Scott, taking kind of a more macro view of developments in the Asia-Pacific over the past year, and I guess the past 4 years, how would you assess Obama's rebalance and the U.S.'s success in creating new partnerships or strengthening existing relationships in the naval domain? Kind of building off of that, how have you, other U.S. allies or partners fared? And I think one of the most exciting stories early on in 2016 was about the submarine bid that Australia had, which Japan ended up not getting. But is defense technology cooperation an area where the U.S. can exercise leadership in the Asia-Pacific?
Yeah, so thank you so much for that. Absolutely. So I think that the key underpinning of the strategic rationale of the rebalance was correct, and it still holds true. And that's that outside of North America, Asia is going to be the most important region for America's future prosperity, its security, and its value. Dan Dresner had a good piece in the Washington Post last week, and it talked about how Obama's foreign policy focus was a little bit like Jon Snow's from Game of Thrones, in that it was right in the big picture about this rebalance, but a little bit negligent in the danger of conflicting agendas. So it's talking about how things like the Iran nuclear deal could be seen in the framework of removing these distractions, but also as how, despite this effort, many real-world events and folks with other goals like Putin get in the way of this vision. So as such, because of this, the record in prioritizing and safeguarding U.S. interests in Asia against threats has been something of a mixed bag. I'm going to focus a little bit on the security front in particular, and I know my esteemed colleagues have talked a lot about China, so I'm going to put that a little bit on the back burner, but it has brought us this focus through the rebalance, enhanced substantial cooperation with many countries, including the Philippines, Australia, Singapore, Vietnam, Indonesia, India, Sri Lanka, and even China. But these gains can be seen as tactical and reversible. As we saw with Thailand when the coup happened, and of late with the Philippines, as Alina alluded a little bit. And this is because our interest isn't singular, and it's not just security or economics or values, but a mix of those, because we understand that the intertwined nature of these interests over the long run. While 8 years without any major conflict in Asia is not insubstantial, several long-running internal disputes and boundary issues were resolved during this administration or moved closer to resolution, other security threats have increased. The U.S. is going to have to figure out how to deal with North Korea, which seems to be determined to pursue increasingly capable nuclear weapons, and as Jim and Greg alluded, a China that's undertaking this campaign of maritime coercion while violating international norms and laws. And meanwhile, on the maritime domain, non-state threats, including resurgent piracy, kidnapping, and armed robbery at sea, an increasingly aggressive competition for marine resources, and we're also seeing an influx of Islamist radicals that could potentially inflame ongoing insurgencies in Thailand and the Philippines. And of late, we've also seen the potential radicalization among the repressed Rohingya of Burma. So there's a lot of different security issues and threats that have somewhat metastasized over the past several years. And on other fronts like economics, we've obviously spent a lot of time and effort in trying to develop the Trans-Pacific Partnership, which I am, in my mind, unfortunately, understand we've now withdrawn from prior to ratification. And it remains to be seen what will replace it. But that surely can't be counted as a win for the rebalance. Regionally, we have seen a lot of participation from the U.S. in things that are going to build and strengthen regional framework for maritime security cooperation, things like the Maritime Security Initiative, the DOD-led initiative to help develop the maritime security capabilities of some of our Southeast Asian partners. RECAP, which is the Regional Agreement for Countering Piracy and Armed Robbery, and the ASEAN Regional Forum. These all have really kind of gotten their feet under them, really developed, and have some good legs now just over the past 8 years or so. But without sustained diplomatic efforts, which is one of the things that Rebalance was good at investing. It remains to be seen how much farther those will be carried. The good news for the region, I would say, is that they probably can, other than MSI, sustain themselves without U.S. Support and participation, but certainly our involvement in them will help them to mature and strengthen. As for partners, you mentioned, I think, that Japan has been quite successful in building constructive maritime ties in the region. It owes in part to what I like to call its patrol boat diplomacy, of helping develop the maritime capabilities on generous terms of some of the partners, whether it's Vietnam or the Philippines or Malaysia. And this is something that Australia has also long undertaken, especially in the South Pacific. India of late has also been warming to this approach. We've seen a couple of new deals between India through its not just look east, but act east policy. And in the future, we're likely to see all three continue to seek out maritime technology cooperation and defense export opportunities. I will just caveat that the exact nature of those deals remains to be seen and will probably depend in many cases on the calculation of both sides, not just in terms of the security considerations, but also, and in some cases, probably primarily domestic and economic politics for things like shipbuilding jobs and technology transfer. As far as the U.S. goes, I'm not sure how much of a leadership role we will be taking in technology transfer or technology cooperation, but I remain optimistic about the improved ties in the technology cooperation we've developed with India and what that means in terms of helping develop naval aviation capabilities. So that's kind of a broad stroke, and I'm looking forward to the further discussion. I've got some questions I'd love to hit up our fellow panelists with.
Great. Thank you so much, Scott. So I think I'm going to begin with one follow-up question, then we can have a little bit of a discussion. Combining, I was going to ask about Japan. Scott helped kind of get that discussion started, but also we have in the U.S. a new administration coming in. There's still plenty of questions about the future direction this new administration will take, but I think we can already say that this administration will be characterized by unexpectedness and misinformation. How are these two traits of Donald Trump's presidency going to shape how states in the Asia-Pacific, including our allies, key allies such as Japan, craft their maritime strategy and foreign policy? And just take a couple moments to think about it, and if anyone wants to jump in with how unexpectedness, unpredictability, and misinformation will affect how Asia-Pacific states craft their strategy in response to the U.S.
Well, and I would like to just put a little bit of a spin on that question as well, if I could, and shoot it over Alina's way. I'm curious what she thinks, Alina, what you think the nations in Southeast Asia, what sort of signals or message from the United States would help them breathe a sigh of relief?
Yeah, I think, that's a tough one, Scott, because as Mina correctly pointed out, there does seem to be a lot of unpredictability and uncertainty right now. We heard President Trump's speech during his inauguration and his emphasis on America first. I think what we can expect in Southeast Asia, and of course all this is subject to whatever develops in the next few months, is that the relationship will be a transactional one, as many people will have said. And that transactional relationship will be conditional upon how much the Trump administration can draw from its partners in Southeast Asia. Now, this will be a bit of a bargaining back and forth between Southeast Asia and the U.S. Obviously, the smaller Southeast Asian nations will not have that bargaining chip to play as well as the United States. And I think some of the signs that Southeast Asia will be looking for will not be forthcoming in the next few months, because I think we're looking for signs of predictability, for assurance, and for stability, none of which have been present thus far. I think ASEAN in particular, given its 50th anniversary this year, will be looking for some form of commitment in at least the presence of President Trump at the EAS, and I'm not sure that we can even expect that. I know that in the past, the U.S. has sort of downplayed the appearance of its leaders at events like the EAS and even senior officials at the ARF. But I think, as we all know, in Southeast Asia, just showing up is key. And I don't think at this stage we can even expect that come November. So all the signs that Southeast Asia is looking for, predictability, certainty, stability, assurance, unfortunately, it's all coming out from the one unpredictable actor that was around and has been around and will continue to be around, which is China. In the past, I think we saw signs of reassurance from the U.S. Against China, but now it's the situation seems to be reversed.
Well, that's a great great point and great answers. And Greg, I'm wondering if you could, and Alina also, if you've seen any, to Alina's point, any policies or announcements coming out from the Trump administration pertaining to Asia outside of the context of the U.S.-China relationship?
Well, no, outside of the U.S.-China relationship, I don't think so. This is one thing that if you're sitting in the Southeast Asian capital, has to worry you. Despite its many shortcomings, I think the one thing the pivot or rebalance did quite well was focus on middle powers and Southeast Asian states for their own right. You know, it situated China policy within Asia policy, not the other way around. For Trump, for most of his senior advisors and folks in the transition team, what we've heard is an Asia policy dominated almost entirely by China with a sprinkling of North Korea. So if you expect a transactional approach to interstate relations, which I think is reasonable, then your perceived value vis-a-vis U.S.-China competition is going to determine in a large degree that value. That has to be worrying to Southeast Asian states. You mentioned the importance of just showing up in Asia. I don't see any reason we should expect a President Trump to go to the East Asia Summit. That seems extremely unlikely. We're not going to see the same focus on Southeast Asian states, on Australia, India, Japan, except through that bilateral U.S.-China prism. Now, the one, I think, biggest factor of uncertainty here, though, is how much does the stated policies or platforms of President-elect and before that campaigner Trump, how much does that actually translate into foreign policy? Because how much does the President Trump actually want to be involved in foreign policy? We've certainly heard suggestions that he's not going to play a very active role, that he will allow a much bigger role for people like General Flynn in the NSC or even Vice President Pence, certainly Tillerson and Mattis. So, it is possible that all of these, or many of these statements from the president don't actually frame the way the administration pursues foreign policy.
Yeah, it seems to make a lot of sense based on flip-floppy scenes from the campaign to what a two-day-old presidency at the time of recording this call. Sort of last comments, I'm still curious kind of how states are reacting to the U.S., but kind of breaking out of Southeast Asia, how are U.S. allies or partners like Japan and Taiwan, what are the kinds of signs that they'd be looking for in Northeast Asia? We haven't really touched on the East China Sea, but that's also a hot spot in Asia-Pacific that's kind of gotten more tense in the past year.
And Jim, maybe that's an opportunity for you to jump in here. I know you mentioned the Red Star Rising, but perhaps you could provide a little bit of a context for our listeners as to what that is, and if you've seen any discussions about the role of Taiwan in the new administration.
Yes. Well, first of all, the Red Star Rising is just an email distribution list that I've had going for 11 years, and many of you on this conference call are members of it, and got a number of people out of the State Department and the DOD and academia and the press that are members, and then people that are in theater from the countries in the region are also on the list. And so we try to follow things that are going on and from their perspectives. And so we send those out. And anybody that's hearing this that wants to join, send me an email, and we'll add you to the list. Secondly, I think, you know, I'd like to, before I answer the question about Taiwan, I would like to maybe give an alternative view about the characterization of the Trump administration. I think Mina said it. I mean, they've been in power a day and a half, one. Two, if you go back and you look at the Obama administration's announcement of the rebalance or the pivot to the Pacific, that was over a year and a half into his administration before that was really announced. And it was certainly another 2 years before we started seeing tangible, you know, aspects of that policy being implemented. So I think, you know, what I would caution people, not just in the United States but overseas, is to, you know, maybe give it a little bit of a breather here. There has been no stated policies on anything, so to make judgments about what they will be and to make the assumption that everything's going to be transactional, I think, is very premature, especially when you listen to the testimonies of Secretary of Defense Mattis, Secretary of State nominee Tillerson, and their comments in terms of the requirements and the necessity to sustain our alliance structure. And even if you look at General Mattis's first statement yesterday after he was confirmed, you know, he said, "I'm to the people of the Department, U.S. Department of Defense, I'm happy to be leading you and the people and working with the people of the intelligence community." And then the last portion of that, it was only a two-sentence or two- or three-sentence message to the department, but he said, "And we need to have friends and alliances." And so I think we need to be a little bit more seeing U.S. national or U.S. foreign policy through a lens of continuity in the post-World War II environment. And our commitment to the international order is not going to be upended with this new administration, in my opinion. So you can take that for what it's worth, but I think that's the message that you'll be seeing coming out of this this new administration. There'll be portions of it that will certainly echo and reinforce some of the things that the president-elect said, but I don't think we're I didn't even hear him in his inauguration comments make those kind of statements. He did talk about the necessity of America not forcing their views on other nations, and so I think there's a lot there to work with. People may not like all of that it's said, but I think there's a longer continuity of history that will be continued. That's the first part. With respect to Taiwan, I do think it's an area where this new administration is going to not be constrained by previous history. So I'm kind of being maybe undercutting what I just said, but I think it's been very clear that this was something that was not just happenstance, and I think we can expect to see more direct challenge to the idea that the United States cannot deal with and talk to Taiwan. And I think there's been a lot of discussion about, you know, what is the one China policy? And if you go back and you look at the original statements from the 70s, we said that we accepted, when we said we accepted, you know, this understanding, it was the acceptance that we understood that China believed that Taiwan was part of China, but that we were not making a judgment on that. And I don't think that's been articulated too much in many circles over the last two or three decades. And I think you're going to see more focus on that. And that's certainly going to upset Beijing. And I think that's, you know, the purposes for that you may attribute to transactional relationships with China in other areas and economics or whatnot, but I think it's an area where it's going to, in effect, we've been saying, what is it that we can do to get China to become a responsible player, to conform to international norms, you know, their rejection of the international, of the arbitration tribunal in 12 July, their ruling. I mean, there was no penalty for China for saying we just going to ignore that. And so I think this new administration is going to challenge them, and they may do it through a indirect or asymmetric approach.
Yeah, Great. Thank you so much for the discussion, everyone. I'm sure our listeners are really going to appreciate this. Really quickly, before signing off, I want to ask everyone, we can go in the same order that the initial remarks are given in. What project are you working on that you're most excited for this year that SynSec members should keep an eye out and look out for? So, again, same order as the beginning. So, Jim, Greg, Elena, Scott, just give us a sentence or two of what you're really excited to be working on this year.
Oh, I'm always working on all kinds of different things, but I think my focus will stay on watching what the Chinese Navy's doing in terms of enforcing their view of their, you know, task to rejuvenate and restore China, and that to include their maritime domains. And so that's where my focus will remain.
Not to parrot Jim's answer, but yeah, I you know, this year I think me personally and AMTI will be looking to do more of the same. You know, we're looking to boost readership of the site, increase our ability to bring, you know, pressure and transparency. Part of this is, for instance, we've just launched multilingual versions of much of the website in Chinese, Malay, and Vietnamese to try to boost readership outside of the States. We'll try to do more of that. We're also going to be looking to do a couple of new projects that move beyond just pulling back the curtain on what's happening in the South China Sea, but trying to take that next step to, okay, so what do we do about that? And beyond just the military realm, which has been our focus, but, you know, looking more into environmental issues, legal issues, law enforcement, et cetera.
Well, I'm excited to be focusing more on cyber issues, and, you know, it doesn't directly have any links to what we're talking about now, which is maritime security, but as you know, operations in cyberspace cut across all traditional domains. So in the next few months, next month in particular, I think you'll hear an announcement about a global commission for stability in cyberspace being announced, and I don't want to preempt or undercut any public announcements, but I think you'll hear some exciting news coming from that space, and I'll be working particularly on trying to help craft norms, rules of state behavior in cyberspace and international relations. So that's what I'm looking forward to this year.
Well, those all sound like really fantastic projects, and I look forward to learning more about those. I do want to take the opportunity before I talk about mine to just thank my co-panelists and colleagues for joining us on this podcast. And for those listeners out there, if you're interested in heading out, and especially in D.C., to any future SynSec events, we often get the opportunity to host some of these great thinkers in more informal discussions with a little bit more give and take in person. So look for those events coming up on our website. For myself, I'm looking forward to, and I'm a little bit delinquent because I probably said the same thing about this time last year, but continuing on our work on the Crowded Seas project, which is looking at the maritime domain in Asia in the 2030-2040 time frame, and looking at some of the potential security implications of what that maritime domain might look like. So if you haven't had a chance, you can read some really amazing speculative fiction that I've written with my colleague Richard Blum on our website. Feedback is appreciated, but don't expect any Pulitzer Prize or Booker Prize winning writing. It's just for fun, but we're going to have a more serious think tank report look at the implications that we've kind of drawn out through using a couple creative approaches to look at the problem. So with that, I'm going to thank Mina as well and turn it back to her.
Great. Thank you. Sounds like there's a lot for our listeners and readers to look forward to coming out from each of your projects this year. And again, thank you so much, everyone, for joining us on this call. And we look forward to getting this out to everyone, all of our listeners. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you so much.
Thanks for having me.